Welcome to the Kenai Conversation this morning here on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna. We are joined today with Dr. Alan Boris, professor at Kenai Peninsula College, and Joel Isaac. I'll let you do the introductions for yourself.
So I'm a Dena'ina person, and I am an adjunct faculty here at KPC for the Alaska Native Studies Department.
And again, thank you both so much for returning to the program. Great to have you on again. And this week, you know, what I wanted to talk about is I saw a little piece in the paper here a couple weeks ago now, and talking about a project up in Hatcher Pass, up a little bit north of Palmer, about renaming. They want to put in a lifted ski area. Put in a ski lift up there. Right now, it's all, you know, hiking through the backcountry and earn your turns and that sort of thing. They want to put in a ski lift, and they chose a specific name for it, and they sort of made up this name as being sort of in the vein of a native word, in the vein of the Dena'ina language, but that's not exactly what it means. And with that, I'll let you kind of bring us up to speed, Alan, and kind of share with us what this means, and specifically what the word they chose means, and then we can get kind of into the broader implications of such language appropriation.
Well, just from the newspaper story, and so they, for whatever reason, I'm not sure, but they chose to use the name for Old Kenai, Skituct. So that was a village that was in the area of the senior citizen Arby's area in Kenai, under what was a Civil Aeronautics Association place that developed in the 40s, now FAA, and then that's been subsequently moved. So the village itself has been plowed over, although there's a lot of remnants of it. At any rate, Skituct, and which literally means we slide down on snow or ice place. More accurately, Chituct would be the word. SH at the start means I. So that's a traditional place name. It's a traditional village. It appears on the 1900 census. It has about, I don't know, about 20 people lived there then. At that time, Kenai, as we know it, the people were moving toward the bluff, toward where what is now called Old Town is. And the name came into disuse, and eventually people moved over. So it refers to the hill. We slide down on snow or ice, which sledding hill, basically, which is still being used by a lot of people to their peril. It's pretty steep. People have fun. And the last part, the T, makes it place that. So it's a verb. We slide down on snow or ice. And then you add a T to it, and it makes it a place that we slide down on snow or ice. Probably a very ancient word, and a very significant word, because the place naming system of the Dena'ina was a combination of usually one or two things. It either described the feature, or it described an activity. And so when you traveled, you knew where you were by the place names that indicated either activity, so you could remember them, or some descriptive feature. I have a long story of getting sort of geographically confused. I think they call that, there's an L word about that, lost. but I found myself because I knew a Dena'ina place name, Island Lake, Nibana. The GPS was lost in the snow by that time. At any rate, this area, Hatcher Pass, proposed area, borrowed the name and anglicized it. So that's part of the issue.
There's two things that come to mind. One is I would argue that they actually didn't borrow a Denaina word. They borrowed a Denaina naming system idea. And they, as Alan said, anglicized it to where they took away all the components that have meaning according to their sounds and just took the idea and was like, hey, this is a cool concept because it's an indigenous language that has an exact name for what we want to do. And we're going to take that idea and make it our own and then call it that this is a Denaina word. And it no longer really is a Denaina word because it doesn't actually have any meaning to it. And that's the fundamental issue. And a lot of the times when something has been appropriated by a different nation, it loses the initial meaning. Mm-hmm. And it's, in my opinion, like it's okay to be inspired by something, just don't pass it off as the original. And that's the core component of this.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. A couple of years ago, I was actually driving through British Columbia, and something that struck me as I was driving through kind of these rural parts, especially a little bit farther south and toward the coast, is that you would see a lot of signs that had not just the English names of the place, but also the indigenous names of the place, whatever language that might be, and I don't know. But I thought that was interesting that they just go ahead and have both names there.
Yeah. Which, by the way, is what we did with the Saltesi Ski Trail trail names. The Bear Loop, for example, is Gaga, which is the Denaina name for the brown bear. And so on. And yeah, a lot of countries have done this. I think they do it in New Zealand.
They do.
You were in New Zealand, right?
And it helps you pick it up, the names and the information, much faster because you see it written. And it's not that you have to pronounce it correctly. It's the fact that you're associating the words with the place and you're making an effort to see that. And you start to see the patterns that appear in the same way that if you are not an English speaker coming to the America, you're going to start to notice patterns in spelling and all those types of things.
And that's just a small example. It's, you know, kind of a small thing, but it does help to sort of teach a little bit. And that's always helpful. That's, you know, teaching is never a bad thing.
Well, it teaches, but it also is identity. So Hawaii very strongly uses Hawaiian names for most English speakers. They're, you know, there are a lot of syllables in there, and they're confusing, but only from an English standpoint. And what the message is we are Hawaiians. This is Hawaii. This is our land. We're going to use Hawaiian names, and you can like it or go to Arizona.
Alan, you mentioned Saltesi, and I wanted to get into that realm a little bit in sort of recognizing Native cultures that have been here for millennia and how they've been influenced by other cultures that have come and that have gone, and what has sort of stuck around. You know, what are we still calling by its traditional name, and what has been appropriated? I think, you know, Soldotna, I think, is a good example of being the sort of same word, but it's been changed a little bit. And
I was just going to say Soldotna, more accurately, Soldatnu, meaning trickling creek. It's the name for the creek that flows in now where that park is in Soldotna. And in fact, it initially was spelled with the Soldatna. If you wanted to get into a bar fight in the 70s, 80s, especially in the 70s, you'd walk into the Maverick, which I think then was the Ace of Clubs or Ace of something, and you'd say, so is it Soldatna or Soldotna? And everybody'd start arguing which it is. And the last sign with Soldatna, I think, was actually in Homer, Soldatna, 60, 80 miles or whatever, into the 80s, and I should have stole it, but I wouldn't know that. So, but the point, why is it a bar fight, and I don't mean that literally necessarily, is that people identify with the names of their place, and it becomes part of them. Initially, by the way, Homer was called Seward. And of course, there was another Seward, and they had to change the name to Homer after some ne'er-do-well Homer Pennock who lived in the area and happened to be around at the time. Nikishka, there's another. I mean, there's three variations of that, and people feel strongly about one or the other, or North Kenai for that matter. Four different names. So people identify with their place, and the name of the place reflects that identity. The identity is a good thing, but the renaming is an act of dominance. If you can control the name, you control the people that are on the losing side. And that's part of the broader issue of place names, is colonialism, colonial control, and potentially decolonization.
Yeah. And I guess, to what degree does changing a place name have that sort of impact? It seems like maybe that's something that right away doesn't have the same impact as, some empirical or some imperial force coming ashore and physically dominating a people. It seems like something that takes place sort of more incrementally and over time, and it's that sort of molding of cultures, or not even that really, just the replacement of one culture with another.
It is one of the longest lasting effects of colonization. To me, it really conveys or communicates that you don't belong here, because the phrases that you associate, you identify with, like Alan's talking about, you no longer can. So you're being forced to identify with another country. And that has very long-standing effects. So even after the initial violence may subside, of initial engagement militarily, that inability to think the way that you were born with or have been genetically inherited from thousands of years of development is interrupted. And so it's much more difficult to then, you're having to navigate an entirely different system with no homeland or core sense of where you came from. So that's a pretty, that type of interruption in human development is pretty substantial. And it's not something like if I were to pull out a gun and shoot you in the leg and then you go and complain to someone and say, ouch, this hurts. They're like, oh yeah, you got shot in the leg. It makes sense that you're in pain. But if it's like, well, I no longer can call my home what it's supposed to be, and I can't associate with the place where feel like I'm meant to live and reside and commune with, most people, that's a little bit too abstract.
Well, and the example you use is with that physical wound. That's something that that can be repaired and heals in your lifetime. But when something is on a broader scale, is the whole culture being damaged, that's something else altogether different.
Well, and it goes part and parcel with language loss. So it's the place names, how you think about your place, how you identify with your place. But for this area, it went along with the policy of the federal government in through their territorial schools to extinguish native languages. So there were people I know who would not walk down the soap aisle of the store, of the grocery store, because the memory of having their mouths washed out with soap when they were children in school for speaking their Dena'ina language was so vivid and so heartbreaking that they just wouldn't do it. I don't know how they did it, got it somewhere else. Ivory soap apparently was the soap of choice to wash an 8-year-old's mouth out with soap. Peter Kalifornsky, noted Native writer, told me the story of when he was in the third grade, so it's about 8 years old, 9 years old, somewhere in there. He spoke Dena'ina, which of course was his first language in school, and his teacher, Mr. Bachman, beat him for speaking Dena'ina. And it wasn't just a whap on the butt. It was a beating so that his legs swole up so much that he couldn't walk for 3 days. And kneeling on rock salt, girls with skirts often forced to kneel on rock salt, and as I said, having your mouth washed out with soap. So the language, the attempt was to extinguish the language. The attempt, sort of the theory of it, was to make indigenous people good standard Americans, rejecting their native identity, rejecting the values and principles of their heritage, and becoming assimilated and mainstream. In his case, it didn't work, and thankful for that. So Joel and I co-teach a class, and we draw heavily on Peter Kalifornsky's work, and I consider it a great honor that this college supports teaching Dena'ina language, reversing the activities of the 1930s schools trying to extinguish the language. And we will do it.
Well, and I guess maybe what's encouraging is we have these stories from Peter Kalifornsky and others, and so it's never been completely gone. There's something there that's been left to sort of build on. So that has to be incredibly important as you think about engaging a new generation or several new generations about what is the much longer history of this place as opposed to just, you know, the last 100 years.
Well, there's, you know, and it's a sequence. The Dena'ina name for Cook Inlet, Tikatnu, and I wouldn't say was Tikatnu, it still is Tikatnu in Dena'ina, translates as Big Water River. Captain Cook came. He conveniently left the name off his maps, so he didn't name it Cook Inlet or Cook's River as it initially was. He left that to his chief benefactor, his supporter, Lord Sandwich. So they were scratching each other's back. So he named the Hawaiian Islands the Sandwich Islands after Lord Sandwich. He named Hinchinbrook Island after Lord Sandwich's estate in Kent, England. And he named Montague Island after Lord Sandwich's surname. So when he got to Cook Inlet, I imagine they had a handshake deal. The most significant thing he found, which already had been found, of course, Cook Inlet, Lord Sandwich named that on subsequent maps. The Spanish came in the next year, Bodega y Cuadra, and Artega's first name, and they named Cook Inlet Ensenada de la Nuestra de Regla. And there you go. So, and that which means Inlet of Our Lady of the Rule, Virgin Mary.
It's so interesting that the native names for places are so descriptive and so active, I think is the big word, but then the Western names are so like reverential to people or concepts that's a difference. And you know, after the last time we had a conversation like this, something that I finally realized is that when you look at the joining of two cultures and what makes that so difficult is looking, I mean, you know, the difference between, you know, looking back like 500 years ago and first contact and the difference in how those two cultures sort of view the world and the speed with which the different cultures sort of expect things, where native cultures live and exist very much in rhythm with natural cycles. And then we have this Western mentality to be constantly changing things and revamping them and make them different or better or more useful or something.
Well, when you have what I believe to have been one of the world's most sustainable cultures based on salmon, why would you change it? You know, we're in a system now where the dramatic changes are our undoing, and we're in trouble in a lot of ways. But if you have a system of based on salmon and other natural foods, together probably the best diet in the world, and an equitable system, gender equity, and other things, you wouldn't change it. So, it certainly goes at a different pace, and our pace is wreaking havoc with us, I think.
Yeah, and it's, I think, maybe just like as a broader at the species level, you have to sort of screw something up before you know how to fix it or that it should be fixed. You mentioned this whole idea is about the importance of place, and that's something that I think is universal across cultures. I mean, you look at the peninsula and see all the places we know are places, but they're not sort of actually places like on a map. Just you go to the North Road in Nikiski, and then you come down like to Salamatoff, and then you're in North Kenai and on down to Coho or over to Ridgeway. And there are all these places to the people who are in them right now here. But
years ago, I drove outside and I ended up pulling off the Trans-Canada Highway into some little park in a little town in Saskatchewan. And I had just driven through, you know, Alaska, through the dramatic Yukon, British Columbia, and now out onto the flat prairie, where the only thing on the landscape was a tall grain elevator and a water tower. And I'm sitting having a cup of coffee and on that picnic, kind of ratty old picnic table. And someone had posted a sign, I forget the name of the town, something Saskatchewan, the greatest place in the world to live. From a landscape standpoint, you know, wheat as far as you can see that way, wheat as far as you can see that way, not dramatic. But it was whoever put that sign up, and I'm guessing most of that town, it was the greatest place in the world to live. That was their identity. That was their place. The name of the place then is a symbol of that. So that's the thing about humans. We associate names with the thing.
And I wonder if that's, and this is just my ignorance of not knowing, you know, historical namings of places globally, and certainly in the New World, naming is so much more reverential because it was done sort of via exploration, and that exploration happened, you know, in historical terms, it was a very short time ago.
It's based off of people. It's honorific. And then it's also based off of you bringing your home with you. So if you're from York, it's New York, because you want to have that identity with where you're from in the old world, because you're proclaiming that to everyone else who's coming from the old world, as well as those who are in the new world already. And it's that sense you're still identifying with the European ancestry, and it is long-lasting to this day. There's still most of the place names in America are based off of Europe. And to make a broad generalization, most Americans don't fully realize that everything in America is based off of a European construct, because it's American and we're independent and we're not going to take anything from anybody. And it's like, oh, by the way, this is all derivative. And it's one of the things, if traveling helps open up that perspective when you travel around Europe and see, like, oh, this is where all this architecture comes from, and these are where all these place names come from, and this is why that sounds this way. Like, oh, that sounds like this word we have for a product on a grocery store shelf. And it's like, yeah, because it's based off of a European language, and we just butchered it here on the label and can't pronounce it because we don't know how.
Right. Well, and because that language barrier is so huge, and if you have, you know, proud people who think their way is the right way, that's, you know, bridging that gap is all about the willingness of everyone to see the other side. And that's how you get, you know, like real assimilation as opposed to just domination.
Yeah. I want to come back to that. But the Dena'ina place name system, of which we have maybe 1,000 on the Kenai Peninsula. I'm sure there were many, many, many more, but that's what mostly Jim Carrey, a linguist was able to elicit from Peter Kalifornsky, Mary Nissen, Fedosya Sakhalov, before they died. I believe it's three, maybe four, of those place names are named for people. And the rest are either, as I said, either describe the place or describe an event that happened at that place or regularly happened at that place. It's just, you know, I'm not sure what it would be for the post-Denaina place names, but we regularly name for people. Usually, you know, presidents and whatever, which can get you in trouble because, you know, I'm not sure all those presidents are really worthy of, like, what was that guy, McKinley?
Is something like that debate finally, I'll say finally, even though some folks in Ohio want to revive that debate, but to see that perception and finally people saying, you know what, mate, this place was called this thing for thousands of years, and the person it was named for never saw it, never had any notion of what that place is at all. And
I believe President Trump is on record of reversing that action back to McKinley.
Yeah, well, give it a week. He'll tweet that he's not, and then that he is, and then that he's not.
Yeah, well, that's the issue of our time, is what is truth. So truth is in the name. By the way, the mountain is actually in Denaina territory, and the Denaina name for the mountain is Troili Ka'a, Big Mountain. Denali is a Koyukon word, or Denali, Koyukon word, and they certainly can see it from their territory. Probably most Dene or Athabascan territories can see it.
Can see it from here, if you're high enough.
Can see it from here, for that matter. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, I'm happy with Denali, but it's a convenient way, or not convenient, but it's a good way to talk about the concept of decolonization. So if colonization is the act of renaming the place to dominate the place, then decolonization, in terms of naming, reverses that action. And Senator Murkowski was active in it, and the Obama administration was active, and I think they made the right choice. Should there be others? Probably. There's a lot. But the act of taking a name and then anglicizing it to make it so-called simpler to say.
Or appropriate.
Yeah.
And appropriate if the sound that you say or the sound coming out of your mouth isn't necessarily maybe pleasing to sensitive Victorian ears.
Exactly. I mean, what you're saying, you're saying it's hard to pronounce, is you're saying, I'm not capable of learning it. Well, if you want to say that, fine, but I think you probably are capable. There needs to be a will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. And that's just it, is there needs to be a will, and so often through history, and especially again, you know, the last 500 years of development in the new world, you know, very little will, but a lot of might and a lot of conviction to other means instead of just learning how best to do things now that you are in this new place.
I think some of the, with the place names and using the Denali reference, there's a fairly universal statement that when you're in, held by Alaska Native people, when you're in someone else's land, or customary lands, you honor that place. And so you could apply that to naming as well. When you start to get like on a statewide, how do you deal with this when we're all under one big banner now instead of in separate areas? That's something that could be done, is like you look at like, okay, is this an Yupik speaking area with a dialect specific to this place? We're going to name that river or that. And rivers can become tricky because they span so far.
Right.
But when you have a feature of it's like a mountain or a forested area or a non-forested area, like this is the tundra of this region, the hills of this area, you apply the indigenous name to that for that land. And then it's a way to honor when they're, when the other people are in your homeland, they're going to use your names. And when you're in their homeland, they're going to use your names. Mm-hmm. And it just, it's a subtle way of the respect for other people. And then I think the other thing too about place names specifically is the idea that you only name the places where people live or reside. And like what you're saying, where they have all the settlements between like Salmatop, Clam Gulch, Homer, like going up the road, like what's in between. And it's like, there's a lot of stuff.
There is so much in between.
There are so many house pits and village sites in between all those locations. And the idea that, that wilderness is empty on shepherded or on interacted space is something that is propagated from a Western perspective. Like, there's obviously nothing here in this vast expanse in Alaska. And it's like, no, it's heavily peopled. And the areas in between become very important. Mm-hmm. And you see that with the interaction of, like, not destroying the forest and engaging with it rather than clear-cutting it and trying to grow crops or clear-cutting it and making a lawn, because that's what you're supposed to do, is have a lawn to look like the palace. And so that's one of the those things that in between, it's your perspective, and that's reflected in language.
Everything is language, yeah, yeah.
So, yeah. It, and that thought process of how you engage with the world around you is very much reflected in the place names, but it's also difficult to comprehend or understand Dena'ina if you don't interact with the natural world. So if you take away those elements that are place-based specifically, you can't understand Dena'ina. So there's a twofold relationship with it. When you take away people's respect and identifying with the region because you're sculpting it to your will as an outside perspective, you start to take away the ability for future generations to understand linguistic component. So there, that's a very... Again, a deeper level of looking at, there's a symbiotic relationship between renaming something and resculpting the land, and they go hand in hand.
This is the Kenai Conversation on KDLL. We're speaking this morning with Dr. Alan Boris and Joel Isaac from Kenai Peninsula College, speaking about native place names on the Kenai Peninsula, how those have changed, and why it matters. As we get to the bottom of the hour here, we'll take a quick break. Stay with us. And to zoom way out and get sort of back to the point that brought all this around is, you know, if you look far enough in advance, my gosh, what happens if someday it just doesn't snow in Hatcher Pass anymore and people don't ski there? And well, now you've got, you know, all this naming and renaming that we've done at this place, just it doesn't apply because the changes that we've allowed to happen have completely changed the nature of that place. And so now it makes no sense.
Well, we transformed the place by technology, and we transformed the place by language. And we need to be thinking about the long-term sustainability of all of it, both in terms of technology and language.
Joel, I know you're going down this path of learning Dena'ina, and how does that has that changed your understanding of the relationship between, I guess I want to use language and culture sort of interchangeably, but how has that changed your viewpoint of it?
I draw less distinction between language and culture as terminology, as part of it. And the part of the negative effects of, and I was put the violent negative effects of place name changing, is that there's a way of thinking and thought that's expressed through language, and it's based off of cultural practices, and language drives that, and cultural practices drives language, so they have a very symbiotic relationship. And so for me, the more that I learn Dena'ina, like semantics, like word order for how you form a sentence and how you arrange a verb and how things morph together and change, it makes sense to me. So when I'm thinking, when I go to like to the store and I hear English words, or when I'm driving and I see English place names, it's really jarring for me now, and less so than before. Like before it just didn't make as much sense to me, and I figured out coping mechanisms to deal with like being dyslexic or how to navigate literary devices in English to where I was able to make it through a master's program and get a terminal degree and teach at a college that's English speaking. So it's not that I couldn't navigate through it. It's just there's all these different coping mechanisms that I had to develop to make it through because that structure didn't make sense to me. And so for me growing up in a home that's English speaking, it's not like I was denying it was my first language and I had it beaten out of me or anything like that.
Right.
I was growing up in an English framework, but there's something that didn't jive. And so it's always having to find those, like, this doesn't quite compute properly. And as I'm, like, learning Dynaina and seeing the structures, it's like, oh, this Dynaina makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like, so much more sensical mm-hmm. to me than English.
Language, we forget the genetic component of language sometimes, I think. And there are many things we sort of, you know, joke about, you know, like the Irish have the gift of gab and things like this. But there is a genetic component to it. And that's again, contributes to that divide that's made it so difficult in some places for these two things to coexist. But I feel like maybe that's changing, that divide is, if there is still a divide, it's at least better understood and respected that there's a divide, and maybe it's better.
One of the early classes I taught with Peter Kalifornsky, which was a great honor. I was going on and on about how difficult Dynaina is as a language, and, you know, trying to sound like I knew what I was talking about. And Peter almost never interrupted me. He's sitting near me, and he interrupts, and he says, "No, it's clear," meaning Dynaina is clear. "It's English that's the problem." So in his mind, as in Joel's mind, Dynaina was a clear way of expressing thoughts, feelings, emotions, perceptions of the place. English was the problem. Are we getting better with it? I don't know. You know, you say, you know, are we, I don't know. I'm not sure we are. Increasingly, indigenous languages are disappearing at a rapid rate, 2 a month, and maybe faster. I don't know what the rate, the current estimation is. And increasingly, languages are gravitating as a consequence of the internet to about 10 languages. So the internet, something like 90%, well over 90% probably by now, of the internet is in 10 languages. English happens to be one of them. Chinese, Russian, so on. I don't remember all of them. So increasingly, not just indigenous languages, but other languages are beginning to disappear. So what Joel touched on is thinking in your own language. And languages, I believe, clearly affect how we think. So if we're thinking in fewer and fewer languages, the cognitive variability of the world is beginning to diminish and decrease, and therefore the adaptability of the world is decreasing. We are in big trouble because we are losing languages. It's very similar to losing a species. If you lose a species, you lose genetic variability. If you lose a language, you lose cognitive variability, and that we can't afford.
That's an avenue I guess I wasn't expecting this conversation to go down, but that's fascinating, and it makes sense because as we talk about the sort of genetic context in which languages exist, and all this provides this deep genetic pool that humans have drawn on to be the most adaptable species on the planet, or one of the most adaptable species on the planet. And it's interesting to hear, you know, from an anthropologist's perspective, what language or what role language plays in the potential of our future adaptability.
Well, the arrogance of English only, for example, in the United States is to our detriment. We should be embracing the diversity of language. And it's not that hard to understand other languages. It takes a little effort. Yeah, but, you know, sometimes you got to get off your rear end and get away from the TV and do something productive in your life. And it can happen, and it will have to happen, if not this generation, the next or the next.
I think, too, one of the things that it just illustrates is that the internet is the idea that there's, like, now we have so much more information at our fingertips than ever before in the history of humanity. And I would kind of challenge that perspective to, it's like, if you're narrowing it down to 10 ways of articulating thought, it's not. So if you look at, like, our ancestors, if they knew at least two languages, I would feel pretty confident in saying that statement. There's the extremely diverse dialect differences that are able to be navigated. And then you have people, like, there's 7-8 different language groups that border Dena'ina territory. So you start to be able to pick up on all those different ways of thinking, and they're slightly different than your own, but they're related. Mm-hmm. And it conveys different information. And the idea that there's information encoded in language is not really communicated or taught in English schools, American schools, yeah, so much. And I think that's one of the why it's so difficult in America to deal with this topic, because the subtlety at which that concept of there not being information encoded in language, and language is just a tool that is pretty sterile until you want to change it, and then all of a sudden there's all this uproar.
Yeah, because people don't really maybe necessarily understand how to conceptualize something in another language. I'm curious, you know, on a very basic level, Dena'ina, are there, my sense being, and you know, just being ignorant of this really, is my sense is that there are far fewer words in Dena'ina because the words themselves carry so much more meaning.
The way that I articulate it, and you can feel free to agree or disagree or add, Alan, the things that are pretty short to say in English take longer to say in Dena'ina. And the things that are very short in Dena'ina, there aren't the words in English to describe them. Or so it takes a paragraph. And because they're rooted in concept. And you're also looking at the idea of what are words compared to, like, they're not apples and apples. So in Dena'ina, you have morphemes or bound words that can't exist by themselves, and you put them all together and you get a verb, which people, as we talk about, like, oh, it's just a word. This is a Dena'ina word. It's more like a complete sentence. Or in English, you have all these small words that combine to make a sentence, and you say all of them separately, and there's a space between all of them. Mm-hmm. In Dena'ina, you're going to have a sentence that you just say as one continuous word.
Yeah.
And so that's a big part of that, is that Dena'ina words are more packed with information, and when they're verb-based, you're providing more description per those very small, if you think about letters as sounds, you can have a three-letter combination describe an English concept or sentence, and it's just, it could be two sounds that you say, or it could be two letters. So the example, like, there's a suffix for ni, which means I have a desire to do something, or there's a desire to do. And in English, you would have to form the word desire and express that concept and with multiple words to have it connect to the sentence. And in Dena'ina, you just put it there, and now the whole thing is an expressed desire. And so that's the kind of the way that I think about it, is you can be more succinct with more complex thought that's descriptive, mm-hmm. where in English you need more words to convey that same level of description. And then in English you can just say, like, one of the students in the class is doing a song for, like, call me. And you can't, you need more positions in Dena'ina to say call me, because there's no indefinite you in Dena'ina. You have to include it.
Right. That, and the entire structure is so different. There's nothing that really directly translates, or very little that would directly translate. Yeah.
It's incredibly productive.
Right.
That is, yeah. It's different. If you go to a English dictionary, obviously there are discrete words, and you know so there's a finite number of rules, grammar, and there's a finite number of words, but you can make a lot of different combinations. In Dena'ina, it's similar, but a verb, for example, is made up of a stem and up to, I think it's 19 prefixes. You wouldn't necessarily use all 19, but you can make incredibly subtle differentiations of meaning by what you add and subtract and to that. So the meanings are pretty amazing, and that's what we're teaching, how to navigate all of that and generate very specific meanings. And then overall, there's also differences. And as a concrete example, there are Dena'ina verbs where the plural means three or more, and the singular is singular or dual, one or two. And so you're thinking in terms of one and the other as self. Partnerships pervade traditional Dena'ina culture at many levels.
So to refer to something in a singular form is not necessarily to refer something as an individual.
Exactly. It's one or two. And I guarantee you that cognitive psychology or educational psychology would be different if they had the concept of one and two rather than the individualism that is endemic in English. That's not a bad thing, but it's embedded in the language, so we assume individualism is the norm. But it's not necessarily. It could be yourself and a significant other, whoever that may be, as the unit of life.
And Freud is just got to be spinning in his grave right now.
Freud said, I wish I would have known that. I could have been a star.
Well, we're kind of winding down, but one more question that I wanted to ask is, again, you know, getting back to the jumping off point for this conversation, which is the thing up in Hatcher Pass, and just the effort to at least try to bring some indigenous influence to modern development. Is that sort of meaningful just in its own right, or does it fall short? Because why not just do it the way it's supposed to be done? If you're going to use a Dena'ina word, use a Dena'ina word and not some weird conglomeration that looks and sounds like Dena'ina but really isn't.
I think that the fact that we can have this conversation answers a previous question where there is change that's happening. Because I don't know if you could have had this conversation in the 60s in a public place on the radio. So like there is some movement that way, and part of that continuum towards hopefully continuing moving forward is to have people experiment and be okay with the idea of incorporating Native identity and language and things like that into public platforms. I feel like there's still a bit of the colonial impact of doing that improperly, and it's that like unintentioned consequences. And that's where the fact that people automatically go to, oh, this is a Dena'ina name for that Hatcher Pass location. And it's like, it fundamentally is not a Dena'ina name. And if that distinction isn't made, it's not improving anything. It's actually making, to me, it makes it a level worse. Because now people, the public, assumes like, oh yeah, look, we're integrated and we're happy and we're being respectful. And it's like, no, it's not. This is just another version of colonialism that is even more camouflaged. And that's much more difficult to undo. So to me, this is a much more severe thing than changing the word for cook inlet from Tikatnu, because they're not similar. And it's very clear where they came from. But when you say like, oh, this is a Dena'ina word, and look at us, we're doing this great thing. And the intentions may be becoming from a positive place. But the effects of passing off something inaccurately as Dena'ina and claiming it with the express purpose of making it appropriate to drive that change, to me is very damaging, and is why this topic is concerning. And it, working with the kids that we work with language, like, you can see it happening because the kids pick up on it. And being a teacher and having to say like, no, this actually doesn't mean anything. And then they're like, what? And it's like, this is supposed to be a Dena'ina word. I'm really excited because I'm learning Dena'ina in school. And now there's this place that's Dena'ina. And it's like, none of those things actually carry any meaning. So try and explain to a four-year-old or a five-year-old the differences between the two is something that I have to do now. Because this is not done in a way that actually conveys meaning.
Right. It's, yeah, largely symbolic. Yeah.
And it's... I have a background in the visual arts, and the way that I can convey it is kind of from that perspective, where if you're using a pattern or you're using a visual reference or a material and you don't know what that means and you just put them all together and the viewer doesn't know it, it's like, oh boy, this looks cool. And then you have someone who knows what it actually means, and it's like, what the heck does this mean? You put all these weird things together and that, like, this means something sacred and spiritual, and this has like something you'd walk on, and like, are you really trying to be sacrilegious here, or do you know what's going on?
Yeah.
The intentions are very unclear. And so if you don't understand the materials that you're using, it makes you not convey that you know what you're doing. And that's the way that I kind of think about it. And there's also this core fundamental problem of using phonetic spelling. And the way that I came this weekend, I was writing a letter, and I was writing the word university, and I started spelling it Y-O-U for university, because I'm in my part of me right now in Dena'ina mind is like, how do I associate the way that you do letters with sounds?
Yeah.
And sometimes I do G-H-U to get that goo sound or go. And so I it's kind of messing with me a little bit. And it just came to mind, like, what if we started spelling university? Why? And you were like, okay, to make it easier to say for a Dena'ina for another person who's learning English, we're going to use Y-O-U for that U sound and just get rid of some of the letters in the middle. Like, we're going to drop the E, because the E doesn't really do anything in the word university, because
right.
It's an R sound. And spell university like Y-O-U-N-I-V-R-S-T-I. Would that cause academic people to come, like, every second grade spelling teacher is in their grave right now rolling over? And it's like, people would have a hard time
right.
with that.
No.
And I'm like, no, it makes sense. That's just the way you should say it. None of those set letters on the page mean anything. Like, what does an E convey in English? It doesn't have any meaning. So it doesn't matter. So that's the same, like, that's the, to bring it into perspective of what this is. As far as if you want to translate the concept of what's taking place, that's my concept. And it's like, why can't I spell university that way and name my college like that? Would that be a problem? And then try and have credibility and say like, no, this is okay. There's no problem with this. I would imagine that would be a very difficult sell, because there's enough of a public speaking English that there's an uproar, and then it's also a governmental system that's backing it.
It's a generational thing, you know. It takes generations to break down, and then generations to build back up in some way. Well, we're just about to an hour already. I want to thank you both so much for your time, and I think next week maybe we can all sit down together and diagram a sentence. How does that sound?
Ooh, that sounds fun.
Joel and I are the two. We are diagrammers.
Yeah,
we
yes.
love diagramming.
That's
sentences.
What we do on vacation time.
All right, we can't be friends anymore.
Yeah, right. Not English sentences, but Dena'ina
okay.
sentences.
Okay.
This has been the Kenai Conversation on KDLL. If you missed any portion of our program this morning, of course, you can catch it all online a little bit later today at kdll.org. I want to thank both of our guests, Dr. Alan Boris and Joel Isaac from Kenai Peninsula College. I'm Shaywin Cochran. Have a great morning.